Good evening, and welcome, welcome. Fellow Dharma farers, I love it when Greg says something like, welcome, middle-sized beings, kind of putting us in the context of the whole world. And today I've been reflecting a little bit on what is great good fortune that we can come together and practice together. We have this time and this beautiful space that the turkeys and lizards are letting us share with them so that we can practice. But what does it mean to practice? There's so many different ways in which we can interpret that or think about it or approach it. And there might be some value in simplifying our ideas of practice. Sometimes we can get stuck thinking that practice needs to be done a particular way, needs to be having particular outcomes. Sometimes we can get lost in the trees and not see the forest. And to be sure, there's value in seeing the trees. It's important. It's an integral part of our practice, but it can also be really helpful to see the forest. And so tonight I'd like to offer a little bit of the forest, so to speak. Kind of the big picture. And we do this naturally. For example, if we're doing walking meditation on our way to the dining hall, we might be with our bodily sensations as we're walking, maybe feeling each step, maybe making a note. I'm often doing left, right. But then sometimes we look up to see, am I going towards the dining hall? Am I there yet? Right? So there's value in being really with, you know, the particulars, and there's the value in kind of looking up, seeing the bigger picture also. And we do this naturally. It's not something necessarily that we have to force ourselves to do. So we might define Buddhist practice in general, with really broad brush, as a movement towards greater understanding of ourselves, a greater understanding of others, the nature of human experience. For example, there is dukkha, right? Nobody is exempt from this. There's also a cessation of dukkha, and there is craving, there is clinging. This is part of the human experience as well. So this greater understanding of what it means to be a human and to have this human experience. But this movement of practice is also towards a greater understanding of what we might call reality. Andrea talked about this last night, that things arise due to conditions. There isn't just magic, right? There's a reason why things arise. We may not always know what they are, but nothing arises spontaneously with absolutely no causes or conditions. And we start to see that in more and more clear ways, in more and more subtle ways, this movement of practice. We might be seeing that things are inconstant. They're always in flux. They end, they start, they're arising, they're passing away. Anushka talked about this in the instructions the other day. And also this, as we start to notice these things, we notice that there isn't this unchanging, steady, permanent self that's at the center of everything. So this greater understanding is part of this, what we could say is this movement of Buddhist practice. But not only understanding, there's greater ease, greater well-being. As we become more familiar with not only dukkha, suffering, dissatisfactoriness, ill-ease, we become a bit more sensitive to, oh yeah, this leads to greater discomfort and this doesn't. It's a big part of practice. It's also this movement towards this softening, this elimination of greed, hatred, and delusion. Some of you may know that awakening is defined as the absence, the eradication of greed, hatred, and delusion. So, of course, the practice has the softening, the diminishing of greed, hatred, and delusion is integral as part of the path. So we have this movement in a particular direction, and then again, kind of doing this really broad brush, looking at what are the practices that help us move this direction? What are the, in general, really in big picture? One, we could say there's cultivation. Things that we are developing, building, strengthening. Of course, mindfulness, goodwill, with the Brahma-Vihara practices, and sometimes it just naturally arises with mindfulness. But also, we're cultivating some ethical sensitivity, maybe rethinking some of our choices we've made or things that we want to do, becoming more sensitive to what's wholesome, what's helpful, what isn't wholesome, and what's not helpful. We're cultivating patience. I'm pretty sure that any expectations you had have not arrived precisely when you wanted them to. And so there's a way in which we're cultivating patience with this practice. Maybe even a little bit of courage is getting cultivated, or this tolerance, this ability to be with difficulty. So one way we might think about the practices that support Buddhist practice, this movement, is cultivation. But there's also another half, another part of Buddhist practice, letting go. It's kind of a different direction, right? Instead of maybe building, it's more of like a letting go, a releasing, a shedding, a renouncing our preferences, the notion that we get to control things. So many of our ideas or expectations are being let go. Whereas I think it was Greg that said, sometimes they let go when we have claw marks on them, right? And to be sure, this is a generalization and not entirely accurate all the time, but sometimes it can be helpful to zoom out and to think about cultivation and letting go if we find ourselves feeling a little bit stuck or not quite sure what to do, sometimes it can be helpful just to think, is there something that is being cultivated right now? Is there something that can be let go? And this can maybe help provide some direction or some support for our practice if we're feeling stuck and unsure and don't really know what to do. And as I said, in some ways this is an artificial distinction between cultivation and letting go. Right? We could say that mindfulness practice, we're cultivating being with the present moment, but it's also we're letting go of distractions. We're letting go of trying to entertain ourselves all the time. But we need both cultivation and letting go practices. And it's not uncommon for people to have a preference for one or the other. For example, for some people, this idea that we're supposed to cultivate something just feels too exhausting. Like, I'm just barely holding on, and now you're telling me that I have to cultivate and develop something, and it just feels like too much. Or there might be some little offense, like, what do you mean I have to cultivate something? I already have everything I need. I don't need anything more. And it feels uncomfortable to consider that there might be something more to learn or expand. Or there might be this sense of, I don't want to let go. It feels like everything's slippery already, and I don't have things that are stable and reliable, and letting go is the last thing I want to do. So we might have preferences. We might have attitudes. We might have ways in which we tend to want to approach the Dharma. Part of this practice is an encouragement, an invitation to maybe not always follow our preferences, to stretch ourselves, to expand our capabilities. Because, of course, if we're doing what we always do, following our preferences, we'll get the usual results. And we're here because we want to have more freedom, more ease, more peace. So an encouragement maybe to see what our preferences are, and an invitation, can we stretch, can we expand? But this idea of cultivating and letting go also can be really a natural thing, that maybe it's the way that I'm talking about it maybe feels like a little too contrived. Maybe you've noticed these red-tailed hawks. I only know they're red-tailed hawks because Greg mentioned them. For me, they were just hawk, like these beautiful birds flying in the sky, and we see them that they sometimes are flapping their wings, and then sometimes they soar. It's beautiful. They're sensitive to the thermals. They know when it's time to flap their wings, and they know when it's time to stop flapping their wings. One time, it was during a month long that I sat here a number of years ago, when the weather was really beautiful during a march, and I spent a lot of time practicing outside. And I remember this time kind of opening my eyes from sitting and seeing one of these hawks just soaring. And there was something that was just so beautiful, just kind of like the freedom of this bird. And there's a way in which kind of like my heart went with the bird just on this flying. This something recognized the freedom there. Maybe you have something like this too. This sense of ease or some more peace or that comes with some letting go. I can tell and also an opposite story. So it's sitting, one of the times I was sitting a 3-month retreat at IMS, sitting inside, because for this person who grew up in California, New England in November and December is very cold. And I just felt like, oh my gosh, I saw the thermometer, you know, 12 degrees. Is it even possible to be outside? So I was staying inside. And I had this idea that I had to cultivate concentration and I'm going to get concentrated no matter what it takes. This kind of really straining and huffing and puffing and really just holding on to this, the object that for me was started with the breath. And not noticing that while I was trying so hard, I had this idea that this is exactly what practice looks like, is getting concentrated. And not noticing how I was like hating everything that was potentially to be a distraction. And I was so tight and brittle and just this holding on for dear life, this kind of like desperate holding on, feeling like I've got to find freedom here. And the teacher said, why don't you go outside? It was great advice. It was great advice. So just this recognition, right, that cultivating and letting go. And maybe I'll just say this is my own personal bias. I find that nature is a support. And I've been told that Spirit Rock was designed the way it's designed, with the dining hall down here. And there's a distance a person has to walk between the meditation hall and the dormitories, forcing us, if you want to get fed, you have to go outside. So this kind of moving the body and being outside, so that's just my little plug for if your body allows it, if it feels right for you, to allow this walk to the dining hall, this time down there, to be a place that can be a little bit of opening or some ways to be a support. But I'd like to talk a little bit more about cultivation. In some ways, there are many parallels between cultivating the mind and cultivating a garden. In the same ways, we plant seeds. With a garden, you don't think about, you don't wish, you don't believe that plants are going to grow. You plant seeds. It's a type of, we might use this word doing, it's an action. It also could be a type of non-doing, but for this analogy, I'll say with doing. And when we plant seeds, we are cultivating them. We're providing them the fuel that they need. Soil, fertilizer, water, sun. We're not forcing them to grow. We're not making them grow. They grow because the conditions are there. The potential for growing is already there. We're just creating the conditions. In some ways, Buddhist practice is the same. We already have what we need inside of us. We don't have to create something from nothing, or we're just creating the conditions in which it can grow. So there's also can be a little bit of maybe a trap or a danger when we think about this idea of cultivating or cultivation, because, you know, we are, for the most part, pragmatic, goal-oriented society. We put effort into our jobs, our households, our education, our vacations, our relationships, and we have the certain expectations that there will be results. Of course we do. But when it comes to training the mind and training the heart, it's not as predictable. And it's so easy to think, okay, I'm not getting the results that I am expecting, the results that I would like. So maybe I should just try harder. And then we get into this tightness and straining and really this gripping that isn't so helpful. So this is part of the art of practice, is knowing when to lean into the cultivation and when to notice when it feels a little out of balance, when there's a lot of tightness in the mind, tightness in the body. And when we do find that there's a lot of striving and straining, we can just ask this gentle inquiry, is there something that can be released? Is there something that can be let go? Maybe it'll be obvious and maybe there'll be a release and maybe not. But just asking the question creates the conditions in which some more space can enter into the practice. So what this idea of cultivating, cultivation, developing, here's a quote from the sutta, from the suttas from the Buddha. The Ganges River slants, slopes, and inclines to the east. In the same way, a person developing and cultivating the five faculties slants, slopes, and inclines to Nibbana. Cultivating the five faculties leads to more ease, more peace, more freedom. Nibbana, awakening, enlightenment. You can choose any of those words that's meaningful for you. I really appreciate this. Just in the same way, like a river that goes a particular direction. The Ganges River, as you know, is really big and really long. And so rivers have different characteristics. Some in response to the environment. Sometimes they are raging rapids. Sometimes they're very languid. Sometimes they are eddies that don't really seem to go anywhere. And rivers meet boulders, they meet obstructions, they go around mountains. But they only go in one direction. It's not like, right, sometimes the river goes uphill. Of course not. So in the same way, the Buddha's teachings often follow this progressive path of practice towards awakening, greater ease, greater peace. And just like rivers, it's not linear. And it doesn't have just one quality. The practice does not unfold as the shortest distance between two points. I'm sure you've noticed. In some ways, I remember that I was on another retreat and I was outside doing walking meditation, and I saw this little bird. I don't know what kind of bird it was. It was on the ground, and it was hopping, and sometimes it looked like maybe like scratching with its feet, like pushing the dirt somewhere, but sometimes it would hop around and push the dirt in another direction, and it wasn't clear, like, is this bird like making a nest, or what are they doing? But at that moment, I had a little insight that, oh, this bird is not doing things in the most efficient way. But that's nature. And somehow, it gave me permission to allow things to just unfold, the way things unfold, instead of having this expectation that it be efficient and linear and neat and tidy and completely clear all the time or something like this. This little bird, I'm sure, you know, it and its other bird friends were doing just fine, not being completely efficient and straightforward. So it can feel like the practice maybe is going backwards, or we're going around in a spiral, or maybe it doesn't feel like we're moving at all, but there is a way in which the practice becomes stronger and stronger, and we are moving in this direction towards nibbana, towards awakening, towards more ease, peace, and freedom. And in some ways, it's like gravity, right? This is why rivers go only a particular direction, gravity. They go downhill. And I appreciate Anushka. I just loved this demonstration she did with dropping the spoons. Like, it just goes one way. The spoons always drop. Rivers always go downhill. One who is cultivating the five faculties goes towards greater freedom. And part of the fun for me, I love to read the suttas. And we find this expression of slant, slopes, and inclines towards nibbana. It's not only about the five faculties. The Buddha uses this simile for quite a few, so many different practices. I appreciate that it's not just one thing. But in general, practice goes this way. So again, this quote, the Ganges River slants, slopes, and inclines to the east. In the same way, a person developing and cultivating the five faculties slants, slopes, and inclines to nibbana. So what are these five faculties? Faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. For those of you who were here in February, James gave a talk about these early in the retreat. I'm going to visit these faculties, but a little bit different, and I'm not going to go through all five, so don't worry. If you're like, oh my goodness, we have five more, and she's already been talking for all this time. So here's another quote from the suttas. Here's the Buddha speaking. Just as the footprints of all living beings that walk fit into the footprint of the elephant, And the elephant's footprint is declared to be their chief by reason of its size. So too, among the steps that lead to enlightenment, the faculty of wisdom is declared to be their chief. I looked it up. How big is an elephant's footprint? 20 inches. It's really big. And all other beings that walk, their footprints fit inside. In the same way, wisdom, all our other practices, these paths to enlightenment, fit inside wisdom. So we might think that wisdom, right, is the big container or big way in which we are practicing, holding the practice. These steps to enlightenment are associated with wisdom, have a flavor of wisdom. So what does it mean to cultivate wisdom? Because in this tradition, wisdom is seen as the gateway to liberation. And wisdom is a faculty we all have. Of course we do. One way we might think about it, it's the capacity to discern or distinguish, to make some distinctions. It's just our natural capacity to notice this is helpful, this is not so helpful. This is wholesome, this is not wholesome. This is skillful, this is not skillful. This is healthy, this is not healthy. So it's not about book learning or, you know, memorizing all these lists or knowing all the doctrines, teachings. But this tuning into what is helping us lead towards awakening? What is helpful? And this cultivation, this development of wisdom allows for a different type of seeing. So these new understandings that are maybe realized or discovered, rather than our trying to figure it out or, you know, analyzing things incessantly, which of course we all do. This is our natural way to approach problems. We want to solve problems by figuring them out. But if we could figure everything out, we would have done it already. So wisdom is a way in which we can, allows this different type of seeing, we might sometimes call it insights. That is, these new understandings that help diminish suffering. These new understandings, these new way of seeing things that bring more ease, more peace. So cultivating wisdom is we are creating the conditions in which wisdom arises. We can bring ourselves to a place where we allow experience to show itself. We're creating the conditions in which things can be seen, show their characteristics. And part of the teachings that we've been giving, that my beautiful, wonderful colleagues have been given, they have been given to sensitize us towards what to notice. Vedana, sense bases, impermanence, craving, mind states. We can just notice these. And then we start to see some of the underlying building blocks through which we build the conventional world we live in, this conventional sense of a self, that these ideas of who I am or who I should be or who I'm going to be. Or we might start to see some of these underlying roots of greed, hatred, and delusion. As we're sensitized to and looking at this Vedana, sense basis, impermanence, and all these other teachings that we've been given. And there's a way in which this seeing, this understanding, that in turn creates the conditions for a deep letting go. We start to see it just doesn't make sense to hold on and to cling and to stay tight. Not because it intellectually no longer makes sense, but just the whole body and the mind, they see, feel, understand, oh, don't need to hold on so tightly. There's a way in this just naturally happens, this letting go happens. And then we might see in some radical way that all the ideas and concepts that we live by are just that. They're ideas and concepts. They are insubstantial. They are very useful mental events, these ideas and concepts, but they're mental events. They are not tangible things out there. We might start to see the impermanent and constant nature of the world we live in. Not only do things not last, but they're flickering in and out. We might start to see some of this unsatisfactoriness, this stressfulness, or some of the dissatisfaction, dukkha, that's integrated or enmeshed in some of the very ways in which we see, think, or hear our world. The dissatisfaction of not being able to find that safe, steady place where finally we'll be able to rest. And if the letting go has been deep enough, the attachments might come back, but now things are a little bit different. Because that sense or feeling or experience of freedom, that non-wanting, that non-clinging, it becomes a reference point that's always available to us, and it throws everything else into highlight. And I'm sure you're experiencing this on retreat. Like, we thought mindfulness felt a certain way, and then the more we practice, the longer on retreat, we just notice, right, that, oh yeah, mindfulness can be even a notice even more subtle things. Can we get a little bit deeper? And so it makes it possible to see clearly that clinging is not what we really want and not where the freedom is. So even any of these little letting goes that happen can be a tremendous support for our practice. Some of the qualities of wisdom that if we have an insufficient amount, if we don't have enough, if we could use this word, not enough wisdom, we might have this overemphasis on just acquiring knowledge. It's easy to have this idea. And we might have these desperate attempts to think ourselves to greater and greater understanding. And to be sure, that works in some settings, but it works until it doesn't. So we might find ourselves trying to find loopholes, or might have this agenda-motivated interpretations of the teachings, or something like this. We might think that that's wisdom, but wisdom at its best comes from this deep and direct contact with our experience as it is, right here and now. And it uses the powers of the mind as a support for more and more freedom. And not only freedom for ourselves, but for others. And in this cultivating of the wisdom, and this wisdom is part of these five faculties, there's a teaching that wisdom is balanced with faith. Faith or confidence. And so what does it mean to cultivate faith, to be as a balance for wisdom? Most often it's a process, not surprisingly. Maybe many of you have this experience that meditation practice started with having the idea, well, it seems reasonable. I think I'll try it. You try it. You have some results that feel supportive. So you continue. Now with a little bit more confidence. So then we might ask, how can this confidence or this faith be cultivated and developed so that it supports liberating wisdom, so that it supports letting go? Because faith, of course, is not the point of this practice. It's the beginning. It's what supports us, but it's not the end of practice. It's not the purpose. And faith, this confidence at its best, it produces this, maybe this gratitude for life and all of its richness and the lessons and the difficulties and the blessings. It supports enthusiasm, galvanizes energy, supports us through difficulties, allows us to move forward without a holding back. Also, this faith, this confidence allows us to realize that some truly brilliant, dedicated, in my view, amazing, wise people have walked this practice before us, and they've left some teachings to support us. They've left some methods and maps so that we can benefit from what they've learned. We can follow, we can achieve what they've achieved. Here's a poem called Finding Faith. It's by this really lovely poet. She's a Buddhist practitioner. I just find so many of her poems really meaningful. So here's this poem called Finding Faith. While pulling the beats, it's impossible to lose faith in the world. Those tiny seeds that once fit in the palm are now large red globes, dense with dark sweetness and heavy in the hand. They are like promises kept, like small proofs in patience, confirmations that sometimes the good that's growing can't be seen. They are like hard truths not everyone will want them, but some will. Some will. I love this idea of finding faith. She's talking about planting seeds and getting beets, these really earthy, not everybody even likes them, right? But they have this dense thing under the underground. Sometimes when we have this, I know I do, when I hear planting seeds, I'm always thinking flowers are supposed to come up. But this recognition that, right, there's something maybe underground. Maybe it's an acquired taste to have beets. And it reminds me that somebody I heard in a Dharma talk, maybe in a number of Dharma talks, which I really took to heart, this expression that greater understanding is rarely good news. Maybe it's beets. So some imbalances in faith is maybe this making a half-hearted effort, or maybe a sense of bitterness, or like just not having enough faith, maybe some cynicism or giving up. Or maybe if we have too much faith, this can be this dogmatism or this certain arrogance about sectarianism, or maybe even being disappointed when you realize that your teachers do not meet all your expectations. Or maybe this excess faith is this inability to realistically examine and revise your approach to spirituality, or when that's necessary. When it's not feeling like it's supporting your life in such a way that feels onward leading. Not to say that spiritual practice will always be fun and games, right? Always be pleasant. I think all of us know that. But faith that's balanced with wisdom, there's this quality of a balanced and genuine inquiry. Is this helpful? This ability to persevere? Some humility? And heartfelt steadiness? And a willingness to do something that isn't your preferences, doesn't match your preferences, because you know it'll be for your benefit. So faith and wisdom can balance each other and work together. And we might even say that the five faculties, faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, wisdom, always given in that order, faith at the beginning, wisdom at the end, they balance each other. And they also have energy, mindfulness, and concentration in the center. For those of you who are familiar with the Eightfold Path, you'll recognize those three, energy, mindfulness, and concentration, as the triad, the three practices that are mental development, samadhi, mental cultivation. But maybe I'll say a little bit about concentration, how this can be a support for wisdom. Concentration is a translation of the Pali word samadhi. I like this word samadhi. In my mind, it feels more like samadhi, as opposed to concentration. That's how it is in my mind. Samadhi has this ease about it. And this is really, I've discovered, is one of the keys. If we think about samadhi, concentration, as a sense of harmonization, a steadiness, a collectedness that's with some well-being. And so when we say concentration, we might think it's this narrow, microscopically contracted focus. And samadhi may have some focus about that, but it's not what it's all about. It's rather more about the mind and the body feeling unified. The mind and the body having some harmony, there being some non-distraction, feeling some settledness, some steadiness. Maybe being non-distracted in a way in which without straining. So maybe a gathering, a bringing together, composing, unification, all these different words. There can be a gathering of disparate parts of ourselves, and because it's very easy to live a life that's fragmented or to have an inner life that's fragmented. And so just a way in which some collectedness happenings. And so samadhi is a spectrum. Sometimes we might hear about samadhi, we might hear about concentration, and we have this idea, do I have it? As if that's a yes or no answer. What does it look like? Well, I know when I've had it. As if it's kind of like a binary on-off, you have it, yes, no. But we can think of it as just moving along a spectrum. More collectedness, more harmony, more steadiness, more settledness, as opposed to yes, no, it's there, it isn't there. And so samadhi can support wisdom. Because with the samadhi, there's this malleability of the mind. As the mind finds its way into this more soft, unified state of well-being, the mind becomes agile. The mind is able to pick up and use different approaches. These different teachings that we're offering, these things that we're pointing to, maybe some cultivation, maybe some letting go. And the more that samadhi is present, the more a mind-body system is maybe able to try this or try that, you know, to do something beyond our preferences and to maybe play around, experiment, explore. I'm trained as a research scientist. I love this idea of playing around, experimenting, exploring. Not so that we're always trying to figure everything out, but it's just this attitude of curiosity. Andrea's been using this word a lot. If you see the other teachers also use this word of curiosity. Samadhi also supports wisdom. Concentration also supports wisdom because it also has a sense of well-being. It's not there all the time. It comes and goes, and maybe there's sometimes it's a little more prominent and evident than other times, but being able to dip into a sense of well-being helps us enormously, helps us to have some of this stability, nourish us, support us on this journey, on these explorations. Samadhi has a quality of warmth, love. And if we think of samadhi, concentration is just this microscopic focus where we're holding on really tight to the object, that doesn't leave much space for the heart, the have its warmth and love. Some of you are reporting that you are discovering this just naturally unfolding as part of your practice. I know for me this was a surprise, that as there was a little more collectedness and settledness, that, you know, I felt a little awkward even saying this word, like love, but I couldn't think of another word. And to be sure, that's a spectrum too. Sometimes it's really there, and sometimes it's just non-aversion. So some ways that samadhi also supports a wisdom is it allows for some refinement, where we can start to see even things more and more subtle. I've been talking about, you know, seeing wisdom as seeing new ways of seeing that allows some understanding. But as the mind deepens, it becomes more refined, and we can see more and more subtle. Whether that's our intention or not, with practice, this just happens. I'm doing this with my hands. There's a settling and just becoming from what's really obvious to what's more subtle. So it can be helpful to simplify practice, sometimes to look at the trees, just in the same way it's helpful to look at the forest. Sometimes it's helpful to think about cultivation and letting go, especially if we're feeling stuck. Is there something that can be let go? Is there something that can be cultivated in an open-handed, generous way? And we're cultivating wisdom, this way it's an experiential understanding, a new way of seeing that supports this movement, this natural movement towards greater freedom, greater ease, greater peace. Which creates the conditions for more and more freedom. And there's a way in which our cultivating wisdom not only supports freedom for ourselves, but freedom for others. For those we come into contact with. And those who come in contact with others, or for those we've come in contact with, but we're not practicing just for ourselves. Our practice doesn't benefit only ourselves. In direct and indirect ways, it benefits others. And ripples out. And in my view, this is exactly what the world needs. It needs people who are cultivating non-greed, non-hatred, non-delusion. This is important work. This is beautiful work for us and for the world. Maybe we'll sit just for a moment here. And maybe I'll leave you with this quote by Peter Levitt. Watermelons and Dharma students grow pretty much the same way. Long periods of sitting till they ripen and grow juicy inside. Thank you for your practice.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.